I think teachers have a lot more support nationally than we think in terms of fighting back against some of this stuff. I mean, I think there obviously are tensions because parents want, want to they are being forced back into work, and they need some place for their kids. But I think what we've seen in Philly, especially when, we pointed out things like the district's ventilations plan was putting, $50 Home Depot fans in the residential fans in the windows. Parents understand that as completely absurd, and that's something that would never happen in the suburbs, that would never happen in a wealthy community. And so I think when teachers struggle around these issues, people are desperate for someone to fight back right now. The weight of the pandemic is kind of weighing heavily on us. And I think, the national polls bear this out, that there is huge support, at least until teachers are fully vaccinated, to not reopen schools. Although as Nina pointed out, I think that support erodes the wealthier and the whiter the parents get.
Well, I'm sorry that we have to end this conversation. It was so great to have both of you here. Thank you, Nina and Adam, for joining us on KVU. And thanks to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at
Prison
6
Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Welcome to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. International Women's Day is to uphold women's achievements and to recognize challenges. My guests are Amy Davidson with Partnership for Safety and Justice Crime Survivor Program and Alexis Robinson Woods, Executive Director of Call to Safety, Portland's crisis line for domestic and sexual violence. We'll discuss their work with crime survivors and the challenges facing crime survivors of color who need help after experiencing violence. Welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thanks, Karen.
So, Amy, you have decades of experience advocating for crime survivors, and Partnership for Safety and Justice, or PSJ, just released a report, When We Tell Our Stories, How Survivors of Color Are Most Harmed and Least Helped by the Public Safety System. So this was a collaborative project. So which organizations were involved, and who did you interview for this report?
You know, when we determined that we needed to embark on this particular project, we knew that we wanted to have a pretty decent mix of folks with different perspectives at the table. I wanted to really be thoughtful in reaching out to community-based folks, system-based folks, even folks that we thought might even potentially be part of the problem too. And so we wanted to bring in, well, I'll just tell you, the partners were Red Lodge, Transition Services. We had Latino Networks, CHI Program, the Community Healing Initiative. We had the Office of, what was then called the Office of Youth Violence Prevention. They've since changed the name to Office of Violence Prevention, which is through the City of Portland. We had the Portland Police Bureau's Crisis Response Team. We also had Healing Hurt People, which is a culturally specific program serving largely the African American community. That's like, well, I'm not going to try to explain their mission, but they're a hospital-based violence intervention program. And then we also brought in the DA's office, the Victims Assistance Program there. And I think that is everybody.
And you interviewed 40 Black and people of color for this report.
The primary communities we wanted to hear from were those that, to the best of our knowledge, were most or at least overrepresented in the criminal justice system, but whose voices were least heard. And, so we reached out to African-American communities, Latinx community, and the Native community. Those are the three communities that this focused on. The way that we reached them was basically like the advisory committee members represented all of these different communities and did outreach to community-based programs to see who would be interested in sharing information from their experiences. And so we did focus groups, we did one-on-one interviews, we did surveys, we did stuff in the community, we did stuff at Coffee Creek. Yeah, and we just tried to make it as accessible and trauma-informed as possible for folks, with like top priority was respect for culture.
And what were your findings?
Well, I mean, we found that folks were incredibly isolated and they didn't receive the information that they needed to get help. We learned that culture was sort of at the center of a lot of things, that the more likely that you are to receive services from a culture that reflects your own, the more likely the needs to address your trauma will be met. Overwhelmingly, you know, pretty much like 3/4 of the time, if not more, communities of color are not actually choosing to interact with systems. The police is not a response that feels safe for folks to rely on to feel safe. And so that help comes from within the communities, which again speaks to the need for keeping services culturally specific whenever possible and centered in community.
So Amy, you did find that most survivors of color do not report crimes, as you said, but many survivors of color also do not identify as victims.
Yeah, I think that this piece of it really spoke to like the really deep intergenerational trauma and epigenetics, and also, you know, really racist views that exist all throughout all the systems that are pervasive and telling people what the limits of their pain are. And like, also it really shined a light for us on the fact that folks in Black and brown communities have historically always been first cast as perpetrators of crime, more so than victims and survivors of crime. So even for those who did feel comfortable and safe to reach out to either dial 911 or like raise a red flag to ask for help, often they wind up in handcuffs, their children are removed from their homes. They experience a whole slew of other experiences at a rate that's just through the roof, that is virtually unseen by the systems that are put in place to help them.
And Alexis Robinson Woods, Executive Director of Call to Safety. Now, this is a survivor-led service in Portland. And what services? Talk about the services that Call to Safety offers and how do people access services?
Call to Safety offers services for crisis intervention, advocacy and support, safety planning, in-person response for survivors of sexual violence, information referral services, emergency housing resources, danger to safety transportation assistance, and then various support groups. Access can be self-referral via crisis line. Other referrals come through the Gateway Domestic Violence Center and with the other partners, the other nonprofits that work with DV and SA survivors in the Multnomah County area.
Are the findings of the PSJ report consistent with what you're hearing from crime survivors of color?
Yes, absolutely. I worked come previously from Bradley Engle, which is a largely culture-specific programming working with survivors of color. I will say the same things there that of you here, that people of color often don't view law enforcement as helpful to any of this, as any portion of it. There is no step in which they are thought of, oh, we need to bring in law enforcement. In fact, they are viewed as the problem because when we're dealing with people of color and other marginalized communities, LGBTQIA+, the deal is if we called, how are we going to get treated? And the secondly being, how is the quote unquote abuser going to be treated? Are they going to get human treatment when they go to facility, or are they going to have an additional assault? So then they have to decide, okay, do I call at the expense of what law enforcement might do to my loved one? You want the assault to stop, but at the expense of what? Not the expense of harm to somebody you still care about and still love.
So if our public safety system is not helping or useful to people of color affected by violence, then what do people need? People of color who become involved with a crime, whether it's domestic violence or sexual violence, what do they need?
I would say community to start with. The whole concept of separation when something happens, move this person there, take that person there, take the kids away from that. That's the system on a bunch or something happens, they start separating pieces as opposed to finding a way to glue them back together. Community needs to happen. They need to be able to have a place where their voice is being heard, but actually being heard, not simply responding to an allegation of an alleged offense, but the other end of that. What do I want? What do I want to happen in this? And what will be the result for me? Nobody asks communities of color what the outcome is for them, what they want. It's just assuming, oh, we're gonna arrest this person, we're gonna process them through. Nobody wants to see that. We wanna know, for you to ask us, a process that works for us, a process that gives us some kind of view that, and maybe reconnect with this person in a healthy manner. Everybody makes mistakes, so I'm not downplaying any of it, but at the same time, the prison does not actually equalize what happened. Spending somebody in prison for 11 years does not equal one day of what happened. It won't fix it, it won't change it. And because we're not using it to heal or change, it's just housing. I mean, it's just storage. It's just absolute storage of a human being. And that's not what the community wants all the time. Now, given there are expectations of that, but most of the situations that I've been in and with the background in law enforcement haven't had anything to do with needing that much separation. Community, building trust, being heard, being able to connect in a way that makes sense, and not feeling like you're the perpetrator when you call. When people of color, when you have to worry about, okay, what are they going to say to me when I get there? And then you have to point out, oh, I'm the caller? That's part of the problem. It's already assessed before they get there that a person of color is the issue if that's who they see. The decision of how the situation is being handled is already decided on based on the color of the person there, or both.
I'd just add to that too, Karen, that, you know, from a lot of the folks that we spoke with, there was a lot of sentiments around, and it wasn't named as restorative justice, but like a lot of folks would express a desire to like at least have more information, first of all, but second of all, like have an opportunity to confront a person. It, like, for example, like for folks who perhaps had had like a child who had been murdered, you know, or experienced some other type of violent crime, in a lot of cases, it was really helpful for folks to imagine, wow, how this would have gone differently if I could have just said to the person that hurt me or took my child away, like, what happened to you? Why did you do the thing that you did? Did you target me personally? Was this a random thing? Like, actually, it helps folks like plan for safety too when they have more information, when they can feel that they have a sense of agency over their own healing and that that's not determined just by what a prosecutor or somebody else thinks is going to help them get safe or define justice for them. For a lot of folks, that just needs to happen outside of a system base. You know, like that happens better with either interpersonally or within community.
Talk more about the barriers to reporting crimes for people of color and their reluctance to call the police.
Again, when folks are first cast, if we're talking specifically around communities of color, you know, Alexis already pointed out, if officers show up and they've already decided when they got there, like who's making the trouble, and then they find out, oh, wait, you're the one that called? Like, that's really common. That's all the time. Yeah, I also just think taking into account the historical trauma and like backlash, insider stuff that's happening, that's like, you know, we don't rely on the system or police to keep us safe. So now you may have experienced some internal backlash within your own community too, if you do choose to make that call in some cases. So there's just a lot of dynamics at play there that came long before this moment in time.
The Partnership for Safety and Justice report, again, is When We Tell Our Stories, How Survivors of Color Are Most Harmed and Least Helped by the Public Safety System. So talk about the power in telling stories and the power of just being validated.
Well, I mean, if you think about storytelling, I mean, it's as old as we are. It comes long before us, centuries and centuries. And I think that, you know, what I observed in the process of doing this project, one thing that really struck me was there's one particular group that we met with that had already been an established group, and they had been meeting for years. And it wasn't until they came together for this purpose of sharing their trauma. Most of these folks were coming to talk about trauma that had happened within their families, usually involving their children. But for this particular group, they had talked about experiences of intimate partner violence and sexual violence and all this stuff that I didn't know this until after we met. But all the things that they had shared with each other had never been shared in that group until that night that they did that focus group. And when they came together, that was such a deeply and profoundly bonding experience for them that they became vulnerable in a way that they'd never had before. Those were the first moments that they had ever said those things out loud to anybody. And so I think that that really speaks to the collective potential for healing. And so I know that one of the people in this group, the larger group of 40 folks who this study focused on, you know, they shared that, you know, when we get to tell our stories, like we feel seen. And that's when the healing begins, is when we feel seen and when we feel heard and believed and all of those things. And so when we get to come together and someone creates a space for that to happen, that's literally where the healing begins. When we realize that we're not alone, when we realize we're not the only one this has ever happened to, and that even after we say the worst thing that ever happened to us, somebody's still going to love me at the end of this, and they're going to come back again next week, and they're still gonna have a space for me at the table here.
That's the great thing about having support groups and stuff like that, as far as services are provided, particularly culture-specific support groups, and giving those affinity spaces for folks to be able to say exactly what they're feeling without it being filtered, without it being muted, without having to be concerned who else is in the room. And that's that concept of community that Amy was talking about, is particularly when there are large groups of people of color, large groups of the LGBTQ community, when there isn't somebody who opposes a threat to them in the room, the stories are great because they're about from their heart, they're about their experience, and they also understand, especially when they start hearing other people talk about similar things, and they're like, oh yeah, we need to get together because I had that happen. They find connections and bonding in a way to enhance their community from having that voice, from having that space to have those conversations. It's empowering and uplifting the folks to be able to do that, to be able to feel heard, and then to be able to make connections and not feel that, oh, this is just me, this is all my bad choices. Is it? No, this is happening across the board, and it is not just you, and it is not your fault, and that there should be ways to help you. And this is just one of them. And that is a huge start, but these spaces don't exist outside of these nonprofits, outside of culture-specific organizations that provide this, because it needs to be big as a whole, because folks don't necessarily have access to these types of groups where they have that. Transportation, location, and those sort of things make it difficult for even go to a place to even that happen. So a lot of folks don't have that opportunity to tell their story and to heal other folks.
And in your own organization, Call to Safety, Alexis, how are you working to make it more culturally accessible?
Well, that's a good start. I've been here 3 weeks, and that's part of my goal. A lot of the folks here are committed to anti-racist work and doing things to affect change. And with that mindset in place, I think the sky's the limit of what we can do. I was previously with Bradley Engel, Culture Specific Domestic Violence Services, for 3 years, and as their programs director. And one of the exciting things they have going on is they just rolling out what's called their kinship program. This kinship program is designed for women of color and their children to increase their bond and interrupt intergenerational trauma of the other parent being taken away and not being around at all, and actually focusing on the child and that they need services, that they are dealing with this trauma as well. And then the events circle around connecting them and bonding them with the survivor parent that's there with them. So their parent is getting assistance in other programs, whether it be housing, EEP, healing routes. They're also getting focus for their children. They have a coordinator and 2 program advocates that are working with those kids. And I think it's great because a lot of it is all about the survivor, and this one's about the survivor and their children and maintaining that bond, and with the goal being that child not becoming the next abuser down the road, but actually getting focused on and seeing what a role model looks like and how not to end up on that same road.
And can you both talk more about how our public safety system fails crime survivors of color?
The amount of money that we spend in this state to punish people through incarceration versus what we spend on crime survivor services, let me break it down for you. The DOC budget is $2 billion. And according to the Crime Victims and Survivor Services Division, Oregon is estimated to spend roughly about $25 million on all services to survivors. So that's $25 million to $2 billion. That's about a penny on the dollar that we spend on survivors. And nobody really talks about that. And so, you know, I think that that's not just a number that's about money, but what that suggests, like the meaning behind that, you know, like, and who controls that? And the vast majority of money that is intended to serve survivors moves through DA's offices. And so that also kind of forces people to have to move through systems that re-traumatize them. And so when you get into the money part of it, it just gets very messy. And so and it also just reinforces the message that systems think that they know what's best for survivors. It's very paternalistic. We're talking about a system that's deeply linear in its design, and it's trying to address trauma, which is anything but linear. And so just by default, it's never going to be a fit. It literally, in every way, it just does not meet the needs of survivors. And that's not even speaking to culture. We haven't even hardly touched that part of it.
Partnership for Safety and Justice usually has a lobby day every year where we do go down to Salem and talk to our legislators about bills for prison reform. What bills are Partnership for Safety and Justice supporting this year?
Yeah, so in terms of House Bill 2002, that is a bill that is being brought forth by a coalition that was created initially by Partnership for Safety and Justice and Latino Network in partnership. And since then, it has brought on just tons of coalition partners like POIC and sponsors and Imagine Black and Coalition of Communities of Color and Red Lodge and Bridges to Change, Central City Concern, like a ton of folks, ACLU. And it's just been a really dynamic powerhouse of a team that's really imagined something bigger than we've really ever tried to bite off before. It's really intended to address like the racial disparities in the criminal justice system, both to those who have been are currently incarcerated and to survivors. Among the things it's hoping to address, the idea is to reinvest in community-based services that are culturally specific and centered in healing. The hope is, of course, too, with survivors around increasing funding for access to community-based services. There are measures in there intended to help folks rebuild their lives after incarceration. It's going to address probation and parole to reduce the likelihood of reincarceration and reoffending, and then really strengthen the role of the courts to actually match the prison sentence to the specific facts of a case. And this is what you're hearing lots about, is some of the Measure 11 elements to things. And then, you know, in specific response to this year's COVID outbreaks in the jails and prisons, some of how this bill was designed is also designed to prevent unnecessary or inappropriate incarceration. So there's lots more that the bill is doing, hopefully to address racial disparities in the system. Those are a few of those things.
Alexis, why don't you give your number out right now to call to safety so people who may be experiencing domestic or sexual violence can call?
Hi, thank you. Our crisis line number is 503-235-5333 or 1-888-235-5333.
And can you say some words to someone who might be experiencing violence?
Please reach out if you can, because that's the other thing. The expectation is that it's easy, and when that person's around, that it's not to call. Check in with your friends, check in with your family, find that support and find that extra help to figure out what you need to do for you. It may not be calling us now. It might be doing something else and calling us later. Figure out what's needed for you to start with, what's going to start for your healing, and start from there.
And Amy, how do crime survivors want people who commit crimes to be held accountable?
Some folks express just a need really to just be able to confront the person that had hurt their family member or them, and to just get more information to understand why, you know, why the thing that happened happened. To hear accountability from somebody that would just acknowledge that the harm happened, so that that person could hear from them what the impact of that was, you know, and like just to let them be humanized to each other, because let's be real, the system is deeply dehumanizing. And so that was definitely a very common theme that was like, just let us, first of all, be in charge of our own story and listen to us when we are telling you what we need to heal.
And Amy, not only crime survivors, but the person that committed the crime the person that is serving time in prison, they need that healing also.
Yeah, and that's the thing that, you know, we still, after all this time, don't always acknowledge, is that we separate like victims and quote unquote offenders into these separate groups. But the fact of the matter is, like, there is an enormous amount of overlap there. I don't know statistically, I don't think anyone really has accurately measured that. But if you're to go into Coffee Creek and talk to those women, you know, who are serving sentences for whatever it is that put them in there, I promise you about 100% of them will tell you that they experienced an enormous amount of trauma before they got in there. And if you go specifically and talk to the women of color in there, as like social workers and other types of people like that, we talk a lot about ACEs, like adverse childhood experiences. And that's oftentimes these days how we try to measure people's degree of trauma. And so typically in ACEs, like if you like check one or two boxes that this thing happened to you, then you screen as somebody with ACEs. But if you talk to those women of color at Coffee Creek and you look at their ACEs scores, it's like times 10. So that's like multiple chronic, complex, intergenerational traumas. And that's not being addressed. And I will just say too, that that is one thing that excites me about House Bill 2002, is that there's a provision in there that addresses providing victim services to folks while they are incarcerated, so that they can experience, you know, just beginning that process of healing for the things that happened to them before they ever came. Because let's be real, that like that serves everybody. Because most folks who are incarcerated are coming home, and like they need to start to work on that trauma long before they get released. And that's a pretty harsh place to try to work through trauma. So that's a very delicate thing.
What is your report recommending for crime survivors of color?
There are four primary recommendations. The first one just being, and I've spoken to this a little bit already, just to elevate restorative practices that are responsive to and driven by people who are directly impacted by harm. The second one is money. Let's just talk money and substantially increase funding for new and existing community-based and culturally specific healing services. And then identify and address that historical trauma piece to Black, Indigenous, and Latinx people and communities, as well as other communities of color in Oregon, because we still don't acknowledge that that harm, that historical harm, it looks different than other harms. And we still don't know how to talk about racism in Oregon and Oregon's own racist history. And then the last one just being, and Alexis pointed to this a bit earlier, about when people do seek help, we need to really improve those public safety responses and other agencies' capacities to serve people who have experienced trauma and survived violence, because not only just around culture, but around like being healing centered and understanding how to work with trauma. I think a lot of agencies now are kind of used to doing that check the box, you know, trauma informed kind of healing. I think people still reduce it to like knowing when to hand a person a box of Kleenex or something. And it goes so much deeper and beyond that, you know, the healing centered approach. It sees the strength and what's right in a person and uplifts that. And it centers that around culture. And it seeks to find, you know, what's the opportunity that that you can see in this person that's going to give them faith and hope and belief that they are more than also than the worst thing that's ever happened to them, so they can continue to move forward.
And Amy, where can people find Partnership for Safety and Justice report?
If you go to the Partnership for Safety webpage, safetyandjustice.org, all one word, / when we tell our stories. And that'll get you there.
Partnership for Safety and Justice will hold its lobby day this year where people can get involved. It's a wonderful opportunity to speak with our legislators about public safety, criminal justice reform. What day is lobby day this year, and how can people get involved with PSJ?
So the best way to get involved with PSJ is just to sign up on our list. You know, go directly to our webpage at safetyandjustice.org. And all and any information that you'll want to know, you can find there. But just to share with you about Lobby Day, it'll be a virtual Lobby Day this year, of course. And expect spectacular. I'm really excited about what Lobby Day promises this year. So that's April 30th. And it's a very big, complex beast of a bill. It has generated so much involvement from so many different communities across the state, speaking to so many of the different issues that it addresses, that we hope to deliver a ton of information in advocacy tools for folks to really be able to have good, strong legislator meetings and address a pretty deep variety of very specific issues that this bill is going to cover.
And you can find information about that bill, HB 02 on the PSJ website. And Alexis, call to safety, can you give information and that phone number one more time?
Right now, I would say as far as getting involved due to COVID would be just hopping online, seeing what kind of work has been done. But I would urge folks to check all the local nonprofits and find something that focuses on something you're passionate about and work with them and find out, because volunteer opportunities are going to come back for all of these organizations eventually, including us. And a lot has changed over the last year. So I suspect the needs of organizations are going to change. And when you, the local folks start working, the urge for the money to stay locally becomes clear. That means we're not asking for federal funds to fund these organizations. We're taking care of our own. So it's checking in, seeing who needs what, checking in with the other organizations. As far as Call to Safety, our website is still calltosafety.org, all one word. And once again, our crisis line is 503-235-5333 or 1-888-235-5333.
Amy Davidson with Partnership for Safety and Justice and Alexis Robinson Woods with Call to Safety. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/Prison Pipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers and thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, bringing you special programming all day for International Women's Day. KBOO is only possible because of our members, so show your support for volunteer-powered radio today by making a one-time or monthly donation at kboo.fm/give, or pick up your smartphone and text IWD to phone number 44.